Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. Welcome back to all of our Evolving to Exceptional listeners. This week, we are joined by Kim Williams. She's the Vice President of People at Walker Advertising. And boy, has she been through and experienced a lot. She has a lot of stories and perspective to bring to us today. But before we get into some of the meat of that content, Kim, can you give us just a little bit of your background, how you got to where you are, and why it is you do what you do?
Yeah, happy to. Have been doing HR for many years now, including a lot of stuff on the kind of employee experience side, and have managed and conducted tons of investigations into toxic workplaces or employee complaints around harassment and discrimination. And then I ended up on the other side of it a couple of years ago, where as the head of HR, I was being verbally harassed and put through the wringer by a chief executive. And it really opened my eyes to, A, how many people are out there experiencing these things that aren't working in places that kind of have that integrity, that structure, that are really following through and living their values, as well as how much bad advice is out there for folks to follow. And I was able to get through mine and come out in a good place. And so I'm really here to connect with as many people as possible to let you know that you can survive this. We need to talk about this stuff more, and happy to share my own experience and what I figured out along the way.
I love your story, and it, I think, resonates with and will resonate with a lot of leaders in HR. I just recently got contacted by someone who is in my circle, who's a senior HR person or the senior HR person with an organization, just joined an organization and really has experienced a lot of direct harassment, not even bullying level, but very direct verbal harassment, and really is operating in quite a toxic workplace environment. And she came in and really wanted to make a difference. And she is struggling even with what steps to take and how to navigate that experience, because it is so hard when the person or persons or senior leaders, and especially if they're the CEO and owner of the company, and as the head of HR, you don't want to endorse that behavior. And how do you go about confronting it? So do you have some, maybe either in your experience or as you've talked with and gotten to work with others who've had this experience, with what are some of the steps with which people can respond in these types of situations?
Yeah, it's really interesting when this happens, because it happened to me, and you find yourself a little bit lost in the sense that when I went through this experience, I couldn't run an investigation out of my own shop. Of course, that would look tainted. And so you don't have the tools and resources that I think other folks may be able to have. And then the other thing is the internal conflict of you're the keeper of secrets, and there's a little bit of personal turmoil that can come with traditionally trying to protect an organization from liability when you may now become that quote threat because you are now filing a complaint from that. And more than undermining all of that and thinking about the blowback and everything that could happen in the short term, you're also considering what other CEO would hire me if I file a complaint against this CEO? Is this a career ender? And then so you have all the usual fears that I think any employee has when they're in these kinds of moments, but then you also have these additional ones. And it is sadly very common. I don't think most people realize how much retaliation a lot of HR folks can deal with when advocating for others or even themselves. And so I think it's super important to, A, acknowledge how terrifying it is and how you manage that, but then also to follow our own guidance and start direct dealing and putting things in writing and starting to essentially build the case that will hopefully give you enough leverage to negotiate kinder treatment by showing that this could go down some really bad roads.
And I think what's interesting is the tendency to maybe underestimate what it's going to take from an emotional and psychological level to go through that process. Just to start, it takes a tremendous amount of courage to be willing to call out behavior that you observe as being discriminatory or harassment, when clearly either the person who's doing it doesn't see it that way or doesn't care that they're crossing that line. And so the ability to, the pressure to do something about it, especially if you are in the talent management and HR function, to bring about the change for everybody else in the organization is high. And you don't necessarily know, I think, what the repercussions are going to be or what the experience is that you're going to have going through that. What can people expect when they are in that situation? What can they expect to have to navigate or experience as they raise a claim against the most senior leaders in an organization?
You're absolutely spot on. It is terrifying. It was terrifying for me. I think for me internally, there's two pains, and I think you articulate that very well. Like, a lot of people go into HR because they love people. They want to protect them. They care deeply. And so what is more painful in that situation, saying something or not saying something? And so for me, it became easy to understand that if I don't do something, I can't live with myself. And so my integrity had to weigh more than my job. Although there's the other side of my brain that's, integrity is not going to pay your rent. Integrity is not going to take care of your child as a single mother. And so for me, I think that whatever helps you get through that fear is okay. I love to tell the story about the first time I wrote my boss something very direct. It was many pages long. I had outlined all these horrible things that had happened. I had said, this is illegal. This is where you lied. Things I knew this person was not going to like. And I expected to be fired on the end of that phone call. My hands started shaking as I was typing it up. I ended up doing it at my desk at work. I saved it as a draft. I walked out to the parking lot. And as I was driving away, I hit send. And I'm like, and a lot of people might be like, that's really embarrassing. That's really shameful. But I'm like, no, that was the best I could do. And that helped me do it. And honestly, the catastrophe I thought was going to happen didn't. And I think that was an important revelation, that this individual was just as afraid as I was. Other people in the company were just as afraid as I was. And I wasn't fired. There was no response, but they got nicer for as long as they could handle being nicer. And then, of course, it happened again. But sometimes I think we have a tendency to build up a certain outcome in our mind, and it actually may not be the case.
I think that's interesting. And when you think about the unknown can be scarier than the known, than the result. But as I've been advising or supporting this individual that I mentioned through her process, one of the things that I've seen is that often, especially if you get to the point of really raising the claim where you're saying, I'm going to go to the EEOC and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and raise a claim of discrimination or harassment. First of all, that is scary for most individuals, even though the point of the EEOC is to make it easy for people to be able to file complaints without having to hire legal counsel. I think a lot of people still get really nervous and scared to do that. And then once they do, they've now put a flag in the sand that, and I don't know very many people who've been able to remain within a workplace once they've raised that level of an issue, once they've raised an EEOC claim, because it so dramatically hurts the relationships. Has that been your experience as well?
It wasn't, but I think that it can be. And I think that there was some understanding that I knew exactly what I was doing. And I went to the board, which was the only body that could actually hold this individual accountable. And they said that they knew about this for a long time. And so I had some that wanted to address it, but they weren't the majority. So I never had their vote. And I explained to them in as respectful tone as I could that in HR, I know where every body is buried. I know every law firm that's ever sued us and for how much. And I already have a sense of who the best employment lawyers, plaintiff side employment lawyers are in the state. I'm not trying to be threatening, but let's not go down this road. And so it absolutely can be scary. And I think that there's opportunities to almost fake it till you make it. I'm also talking to someone right now who calls me at the end of the day, and I can tell she's finally exhaling, and she says it's really tense right now. And I'm like, absolutely, and it will be. But I think that there's an opportunity, and this is what I did as well. When I'd walk in these meetings with folks, I just acted like nothing was wrong. if they change any behavior with you at that particular point, they're now sliding into a potential retaliation claim. And I think it's good for folks to understand that discrimination can be very hard to prove. The burden is on the complainant. But once you file a legitimate complaint, any negative action that's taken towards you, the company now has to explain that. And in some degrees, people are actually quite bubble wrapped. And so while it may feel very intense, if you have an HR person who has the tiniest inkling and knowing what they're doing, they're going to understand that. Now, they may be saying that, may not be heard, but the company is actually putting itself at great risk, and they're more afraid than you actually may be in a lot of cases.
Yeah, which is why I think a lot of companies tend to respond to those situations with severances, right? With how do we resolve this where you go away and this goes away and it's not a problem anymore. And many, many a body in organizations has been buried using severances, right? That's where you hear, especially around the Me Too movement and in the entertainment industry, and where sexual harassment was able to be covered up for decades. And certainly also discrimination falls within that category as well, where a bad behavior is able to be masked by saying, okay, let's just go our separate ways and I'll pay you off to not file this claim, to not raise this claim or this issue. And that really does a disservice, right? Because now the issue is not resolved. Now nothing has changed as a result of that effort. But it can be really difficult to go through the process of filing a complaint and having that be made public and having people be aware of the facts or the circumstances or the situation. Do you see, or how do you advise others, or what do you see as the most effective path forward for organizations to mitigate against that being the only outcome? Are there practices that organizations could put in place or other strategies that would prevent it from having to get to that point where bad behavior gets covered up?
Yeah, I think the laws are changing in that direction. And you're even seeing that where somebody could sign an agreement and then the feds are overriding that and they can still talk anyway. And so I think if companies are really trying to looking at what's out there, you're seeing breach of contract for not following their own policies when a claim comes forward, or if it was mishandled, that can cost an enormous amount of money. You're seeing shareholder derivative suits that are going after boards when evidence comes out that they knew of an executive who harassed someone and therefore has jeopardized their interest. And then you also see publicity. Public companies, you'll see massive hits within one day if a chief executive has engaged in such kinds of behavior. But I also like to tell folks too, you're really just one viral TikTok away from ruin. And so Gen Z, they don't even care if they sign these agreements or not. They will still go blast you. And I have seen some that where there was one just disgusting case where it was an abusive boss who was screaming obscenities, went to slap a woman, and Mr. still hit her hand. And she's filming him the whole time. And he's screaming F words at her. And he doesn't even care. That's how bad he is. That video ended up being viewed 8 million times. And it got national news coverage. And so when you think about how that company will be able to come back, how that contractor will be able to come back, it can really be ruinous. Fixing the problem is free. Having one hard conversation, holding people accountable is a lot cheaper and less painful than some of these other options. So it's really in a company's best interest to just, as soon as you hear something, do something and really listen to people and be fair in how you respond.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point with the most recent rulings around the severance agreements that state that the non-disparagement clauses are the clauses where you can talk about what went wrong or what wasn't good in that workplace, that those are no longer going to be held. People aren't going to be held to those. Now, the challenge with that is it doesn't extend to executive leaders. So if you're a senior leader, if you're a vice president or a senior leader in an organization, you won't get that. Necessarily that same protection, you won't be able to have that. But for the general populace, that provides a much needed avenue that you can take a severance and you can still talk about, as long as it's truthful, the things that you experienced and the things that went wrong, which is a big step in the right direction to creating accountability, right?
Absolutely. And I see more laws coming. You see a change in employment law and labor laws in the United States every single day. And California, where my company is based, is very forward leaning in this area. But now so is Colorado, the city of Chicago, Illinois, New York City, and the state of New York, DC, where I'm now based. It's almost like a competition to push through these. And the feds, too, like they took that law that immediately passed with just sexual harassment. And they're like, no, it needs to include race discrimination as well. And so I don't see any of it as a one and done. I definitely see this. And then I also see folks that are just quitting without finding an agreement and are free and clear to talk. And then in a lot of these older agreements, the penalty is so small and they can't really put in a big penalty. So if somebody got a really large settlement, they may not mind paying that small fee to put you on blast or to back up somebody else that they know is hurting. Companies, the old ways of hiding things are really changing.
And shifting to, because so I'm an attorney back, so the legal aspect and doing things legally is always a good thing to do, right? We always want to follow those laws. And also the effects, the reason those laws exist in the first place is because of the negative effects and consequences of those actions. And so you give the example of that viral video of the person being harassed in such an extreme way. And I think it happens far more frequently than a lot of us are aware of. And especially when you get maybe not into those extreme examples, but into maybe the more common levels of discrimination and harassment that happen. And the consequences of that to business performance, to the experience that people have and to what they're delivering, I think is the thing that often, and I'm hypothesizing here, is not considered by those executives. They're not considering how when they treat people in that way or when their people are at such a high level of stress because they are experiencing that type of environment, how much that's negatively impacting performance, right?
Oh, I completely agree. And I think the good news is now that performance metrics are becoming so much more widely available and accessible, and it's very clean, and you're able to measure performance in so many ways that we couldn't do before. But there's a simple formula that's out there now where if you take the one brilliant jerk, the one who maybe brings in, let's say, $1 million in revenue, and in my experience, those tend to be the ones where everybody knows something bad is happening, but the boss doesn't feel like there's enough costs there to actually address it. But if you look at who works around them, who is subjected to this behavior, and say you take 10 individuals and you take their salaries and just cut 40% off of it, flush it down the toilet because those folks are reeling from being mistreated. They're looking for other jobs. They're checked out. They're quiet quitting. Any of those things that you want to use, that's a safe bet. And in some cases, it can actually be much higher where people start calling in, or I know people who will take FMLA and go out on leave to get away from folks. And then you're looking at lost opportunity costs if they supervise folks. And so I think that number, not that we should have needed it to begin with, is getting more and more clear by the day. But I also think it helps folks who are more business minded. And they're usually individuals who aren't subjected to the abuse because they're at the very top. Might be able to see something a little more clearly through that.
Yeah. And I think I always like to bring the neuroscience perspective because that's what we're all about with Evolving to Exceptional, is understanding kind of our neurobiology there. And when it comes to the response to those type of stressful situations, to people being mistreated or feeling like they're discriminated against, even if they're not actually being discriminated against, just the perception that they are, or the perception that they're in that situation because they lack information or understanding as to why decisions are being made, is going to put people's nervous systems and their bodies into a state of stress. And it's going to do that on an unconscious level, on a biological level. So they're going to be triggered in response to those situations. And they're not consciously decreasing their work performance in all scenarios. There may be situations, like you said, where people want to take FMLA and it really does. They're intentionally impacting their work. But I think in a lot of cases, especially when it comes to quiet quitting, it may not all be conscious. Some of it may truly be on a subconscious level, that in order to deal with that level of stress, there's a disengagement and there's some safety walls that go up and there's a unwillingness to maybe engage in healthy conflict and resolution because they don't feel safe enough to raise the issue or to bring the issue so that it can be resolved at an early enough level before it raises to the level of truly being a legal issue. And so I think organizations that can create that safe environment are going to see the benefits of engaging in that conversation well before it escalates to the more serious lawsuit prone type of behavior.
Oh, that's a brilliant perspective and something I certainly felt as I was going through that. So it makes absolute sense.
So what do you advise or what do you see as some of the most beneficial things that people can do to create those types of cultures, to create environments where people understand and where they can engage in those conversations before it gets to having the legal issues and having to deal with lawyers and the EEOC and all of those types of things?
It really starts and stops at the top. If you've got to have that buy-in, and even sometimes if people have blind spots, but they're open to listening, I think it can be okay. But those communications that come from the top of an organization, whether it's direct statements or just through their behaviors and action, are extremely powerful. And trying to build up those cases for those folks that are right around them on why this is important and why people need to hear that and speaking to that. But I also think there's just got to be accountability. I work in an organization, some of the nicest people I've ever met. We've had very few instances, but I get to enjoy a high level of trust from my boss. And so if I hear of somebody mistreating someone or otherwise hurting somebody on their team, I'm on the phone in 5 minutes. There's no waiting. I'm like, talk to me. Tell me what's going on. I want to hear all perspectives. I don't jump ahead of the gun. But I know that ripples out. And even though I won't be talking about those things, people know and feel that they're being protected. And that's really so critical. And so I think we can write all the policies we want, but if we're not enforcing them, or we're enforcing one set of rules for the low-ranking folks and then a different set of rules for the top, you're really creating a lot of exposure and opening yourself up to a culture that nobody's really going to love.
So as people navigate that experience, or as they look at those challenges, I think I said earlier, oftentimes it's either that leaders aren't aware or they're aware and they don't care. Do you have a sense of what percentage falls into those two categories? Do you think it's often just a lack of understanding of the actions that they're taking are having an impact, or just a belief that it doesn't matter, that they should be able to do what they want?
This may sound callous, but I think it's essentially always their fault, right? Say when you're ignoring it, that's one thing. But if you don't know, my initial question is, why don't you know? If the buck stops with the CEO, are people around you afraid to raise these issues? Like, what is going on there? Because if there's a high degree of psychological safety and trust, people should be able to come to you with a problem like that. So I feel like, for me, I have a hard time understanding how you don't know. I feel like that's an indicator that something may be wrong.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, a really good piece of advice for CEOs and senior leaders out there, that if people aren't coming to you with challenges, that it doesn't necessarily mean they aren't there. It may mean that there's not enough trust there to really be telling you what's really, really going on. And in reflecting on my own career history, I'm not sure that there was ever a time, no matter how hard we worked at creating psychological safety and having an engaging workforce and doing the right thing, that there wasn't challenges happening. And so if you're not hearing about I think challenges are always there, even in the very best of workplaces. And if you're not hearing about anything, it's probably that people don't trust you enough to tell you, rather than that it's not there, because there's enough miscommunications and challenges and things that happen within an organization that typically the issues are there. It's just your awareness of them. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're messy. People just don't fit into nice, tidy boxes. And that's just human beings working together. There's always going to be something.
And people mess up too, right? Where it's not necessarily systemic, but there was an incident or there was a challenge or people were under extreme stress. And in the world today, and I've talked about this in some of my other episodes, I think given what we went through with the pandemic, stress levels are much higher than they have been in the past. We like to think we've recovered and moved on. But what I'm observing, at least anecdotally, at least, is that many people are still under, at least on an unconscious level, a lot of stress. And so things that didn't used to trigger us today in ways that we might not have been bothered before. And so there may be actually more sensitivity required in today's environment than in environments of the past, because the tipping point is just higher. It's just easier to put people into that highly stressed fight or flight kind of state of existing.
Oh, without a doubt, especially when I think about parents, like the kids are in extreme crisis. You have lost learning. You have a lot of depression and anxiety. It's childcare. I'm thankful I have a teenager now in the sense that I don't even know how parents are making it with young kids for those who are being called back in the office. Yeah, there's some legitimate extreme pressure, I think, on a lot of workers today. And yeah, that all that stuff definitely can show up in the workplace.
And does, right? Part of the, when you talk about the explosions, even that viral video, one of the thoughts that comes through my mind is, what is that person going through? The person that's yelling, what is happening in their world that they think slapping or trying to hit an employee is a good idea? There's something is really off on a deep level and maybe so significant they're not even appreciative of where they are, of how bad it's gotten. And you talk about parents with young kids. I've got 4-year-old girls and a 7-year-old boy. And yeah, there's learning challenges due to COVID and delays in learning. There's social challenges where kids are having to relearn some of the social aspects that they missed during the pandemic. And of course, mental health rates of kids are incredibly concerning right now. And so you put all that together, and we may have more instances of harassment and bullying and bad behavior that we may not have had in the past. And people may not be equipped with the tools that they need or the self-awareness they need to have to manage it effectively.
Yeah, I completely agree. And yeah, and you're definitely seeing that in the schools, I think, in a very pronounced way that they haven't seen before.
What do you see as a vice president of people? We've talked a lot about this discrimination and harassment issue and challenge. What are you seeing as some of the biggest current challenges that you're having to navigate or support your organization with in the world of work today?
I think it comes down to words. Fundamentally, in my view, like anytime you're talking about discrimination and harassment, ultimately what you're talking about is abuse of power. And a lot of that is held in place by a lack of language. And so I tried to read everything I can on what words are we missing? Why does it feel so hard to navigate this gray space that we're in? And trying to encourage people, whether they mess up or not, to have the heart and the courage to have conversations when they're small before they get big. And you can even begin with, this is probably not going to come out right. I'm trying really hard to communicate X, Y, or Z. I'm seeing these types of things because all this stuff, these are systemic problems, and no one big thing is necessarily going to fix them. So the more of us that can find that courage to engage and build up that vocabulary and build up that comfort, because it does get easier every time you do it, I think that's a giant win for us. But I also think that there's a tremendous onus on HR to really redefine itself. Dozens of new laws have come into effect to make things better. Employees are being braver and coming forward and calling out things that aren't right. But HR, I feel like, is still stuck in the past. And we're still locked into that middle space between upper management and the employee that is complaining. We're not transparent enough. We're not taught how to navigate power imbalances ourselves. And so a lot of it's kind of trial by fire and learning painful lessons as you go. But I think I would love to see HR as a profession declare boldly, we are here to protect the company, which means protecting the employee and not the mean one or the highest paid one, but to protect everyone. And in doing that, we're going to train ourselves, we're going to certify ourselves, we're going to basically take oaths to that effect. and make that a known commitment. So it's almost like you don't have these one-off incidences with HR kind of getting beaten to a pulp because they're trying to navigate that space. But collectively, an entire industry coming forward saying, this is who we are, here are our values, and here's our integrity.
I think that's such an interesting concept to think about when you think about the importance of HR, importance of whatever you call that function, the people-focused function, and the challenge with the development of those that are leading that function. Because in most cases, and I talk to a lot of HR people, having them on the podcast and talking about their challenges, and everyone's trying to do the best that they know how to do, and they're trying to offer the best that they can to create the results they think they're going to get. I think some of the challenge is that what worked before doesn't work the same way anymore. And we know that now definitively. So if we keep trying to use the same strategies, a great example is doing just traditional annual performance reviews with ratings that we know there's so much data that shows that those don't create the performance results you want to see out of them. There's a whole neuroscience-based reason why that is, that we can prove with studies and research, is that, but then we keep doing it anyway, because it's the thing we were trained to do. It's at least we're giving people feedback. At least we're doing that. That's part of HR's job, is to do performance reviews. But is it? Is that the job of HR anymore? Or does it need to be something different? Does it need to evolve into new practices or new ways of looking at how to support people in the workplace?
Yeah, I think the pandemic tore down a lot of old rules, and then now you've got AI coming in. And so I feel like we just live in a world where like constant change is the norm. And for some folks like myself, I love change. I think change is exciting. I associate it with opportunity to make things better. But I know for a lot of folks, it's terrifying and extremely painful. And I think there's a lot of people who would like for it to go away. But every time I turn around, like we talked about the changes in employment law, there's also changes in technology that, to me, really reduces a lot of the administrative burden of what HR does. And I think that's a gift, because I think that means that it frees us up to really get into the weeds and untangle those incredibly complex problems that people can bring into the workspace. And to me, that's far more exciting than check these boxes and filling fours out. Because I'm like, I don't like managing that stuff either, especially if you're not really seeing some type of meaningful result, especially if it's reinforcing this idea that I'm your annoying mom who's here to make you do these other types of things that don't help you in your career, don't make you feel like you're moving forward and growing.
When I think what's interesting is that when you look at, again, like the neuroscience behind change, and how, even though I'm like you, I actually love change. I love new technology and trying it out, and I'm always doing it. But the reality is that our bodies are programmed to use the least amount of energy possible in order to survive. So our brains and bodies will resist change, again, on an unconscious level, not necessarily a conscious level, in order to conserve energy. And so if we've created a neural pathway of a particular habit or a particular behavior, then our bodies want to keep doing it that same way because it takes the least amount of energy. And so it actually takes some pretty intentional work to create those changes, to create those new neural pathways and ways of operating. And so it's much easier for people to fall back into their old patterns of how they interact with others, or being very reactive, or not being able to manage their emotions, or whatever the thing is that you're trying to develop or grow, than it is to actually make the shift or make the change. And so I often tell people, when it comes to change, don't feel bad. Your body's trying to conserve energy. The fact that you are struggling to make changes is actually a physiological phenomenon. And we still have to adapt to the environment that we're in. So we've got to figure out how to work with it in order to bring about those changes, or in order to bring about those outcomes or those results.
Wow. Now I understand why I binge Netflix and chocolate bars instead of going to the gym. So that's the thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. Your brain wants to relax. It doesn't want to expend that excess energy. And so to create those new habits or those new approaches requires a focus on understanding what's getting in the way. Why did that pathway form in the first place? And bring about change on a biological and neurological level. And the good news is we can do that. We have the tools and resources to do that. But most performance programs, especially when it comes to human resources, are not built around those principles. Most of us that are in these spaces didn't learn those skill sets, didn't learn that science. And so we're operating off of a lot of past research when it comes to performance. One of my favorite questions that I love to ask my guests is, what is one thing if you could bring to your organization right now, if there was one thing that you felt would really bring value to your business or to your company and would help to support your people and your business the most, what would you bring to them?
Right now, we're really looking at career pathing. And so making sure that there's a clear line of sight to grow. We do this on an ad hoc basis. We like to really try and reach out to folks, particularly at the beginning, because we're a fully remote company. And so we want people to feel our love for them right from the get-go. And we bring gifts and we have automatic surveys, but then we also like to reach out to them afterwards. After about 30 days, send them a Starbucks gift card and say, can we have coffee and just talk? And a lot of times people will communicate out like, oh, I've always dreamed of going into the creative team, or I've done that. And so we'll work with them and even inform those managers that, hey, we have somebody over here that would love to work with you one day, and try and build that path one-on-one. But we're really excited about the idea of creating more structure. We think the best employees are the ones that you already have. We do have a lot of great people, and it's definitely my preference to try and love them and support them and help them grow where they are, because I just think it can be a win for them and for us.
So how do you do that? I'm curious, especially in such a challenging and dynamic world of work where there's a lot of talk that within 10 years, most of the jobs that exist today will be completely different, things of that nature. How do you create the career paths that take into account that things are shifting so much and give people confidence that by the time they get there, that'll still be the path or that'll still be the case? I'm curious to understand how you're going through that process.
Yeah, because I think it almost touches on why it's needed, in the standpoint that the days of just one and done are over, right? Even in our own fields that we've been in forever, like, you constantly have to keep learning. And so I think more than maybe like just the structure, but just building like these pathways of certain core skills, which lets you go a little bit wider, reinforcing that message that it's never done, but saying, as of right now, it looks like this. If you can get this, you're going to have a good baseline. And then here's some other options to help you advance and stay current. The good news is, like, we do a lot with LinkedIn Learning, and we have a lot of partners that never stop making new content. And so you really just have to plan on constantly monitoring that and really driving at kind of skills, broader knowledge, abilities, those types of things, and building out frameworks where job descriptions match those, reviewing those annually, making sure that we are keeping pace, because you're right, like, those days are over. There's nothing one or done with anything anymore.
Yeah. And you mentioned AI earlier, and I think a lot of that, now we have such access to information at our fingertips. Like, we can get information so quickly. As before, we had the internet, so we could always search that way. But with ChatGPT and the AI tools, you can get information really quickly. That sounds nice too, right? It basically explains things to you. And one of the things I've said recently is, it's so much less about what you know and so much more about how you keep growing, how you keep learning, how you're expanding, how you're able to access and use the information that's available, or the knowledge that's available. And a lot of times I like to think about that in terms of vertical in addition to horizontal development. If horizontal development is increase in skills, knowledge, and experience, then vertical development is, and I don't know about you, but I feel like that's the missing piece in a lot of development programs. It's easier to create courses around communicate better, or how to learn to use Microsoft better, or to develop those skills, or even to have those experiences. It's much harder to really do the self-awareness work and the expanding and growing our vertical development or adult development to gain that bigger perspective. Has that been your experience as well?
Oh, yeah. And it's even more challenging in a remote world.
Oh, yeah. I can see that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I had the good fortune of spending a lot of years at the State Department, where the entire structure is set for, if you're brand new at something, you're a backbencher, but you're at least in the room. And you're learning so much more than whatever topic they're talking about. You're looking to see, okay, this person's a leader because here's how they manage conflict. Here's how they present their ideas. Here's how they process information. And so you get so much more from just whatever technical thing they may be talking about, but you're learning how to lead in that particular environment. And so it does become far more challenging with some of that stuff. And I think it does drive much more of an emphasis on soft skills. And I've been trying to work on some of that with my own team. When I know folks want to grow, we're doing one-on-one check-ins where I know I can no longer model a certain type of behavior for them. And so what I've had to do is reframe and say, okay, I'm dealing with a particular challenge. Just as a thought exercise, take it. Talk to me about how you would break it down. There's no right or wrong answer. Let's just walk a few threads down. Here's what I see happening. Is that what? And trying to have these deliberate conversations around these core problems so that people know how to step up to the plate when it's time for them to do it on their own.
I love that. And I think that it's just so essential and necessary. And in the remote world, being able to have those interactions, I think is going to bring those that you're working with just a ton of value. So I'm curious, one other question I like to always ask is, as an HR leader, what is something that you most need? What is something that that would bring you value as an HR leader that maybe you're missing or don't have today?
I think it's trust. I know this is controversial for some folks, because a lot of people will be like, does HR deserve its bad reputation? And I argue, yes, it's, a lot of things aren't our fault. A lot of things were outside of our power, but I think it's time to claim more power and to talk about the value that we bring in all these different ways. And so I know bit by bit when I go into these places, particularly when I am focused on accountability, it opens up a whole world where people now come forward because they feel like there's no more fear of retaliation. They actually feel like there might be a fair process. But it's hard to also communicate that out when you live in a confidential world. So I can't be like, oh, look, you can talk to me because I just did this with your coworker. You have no deliberate correctness. They just have to get a sense of it. And some of that can be tangible, where someone knows they made a complaint and that person's no longer with the company. And they can assume why. But I think that trust all the way around the board to recognize that, okay, HR may be perceived as something, but that's not everybody. And I do think most people who go into this field have huge hearts and want to do the right thing. And sometimes they're just bound by other circumstances. And having that trust coming from others and trying to figure out on our side how to encourage more trust, I think is really key right now.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about trust is it's an emotion that comes from our heart, that we trust other people, but safety is required. We have to feel safe before we can have trust. And when I talk about from a neuroscience perspective, we have neurons in our gut, and our gut is really responsible for our safety. It's one of the reasons why, you know, if you're going down an alley and you say, I've got a bad gut feeling, you've got that kind of intuition. Our gut is really responsible for our safety. It's also responsible for our taking action. And so if people don't feel safe, if they don't feel like they can trust HR, or they can trust a person with the information that they're going to share, then they're not going to have the trust to do, they're not going to take that action. They're not going to do that. And one of the interesting experiences I had once in my career is I had a number of individuals who came to me with concerns about bias and how women were being treated at the time. And when I raised the issues, one of the pieces of feedback that I got, or I got asked, can you name names? Can you tell me who told you that or who said that? And at the time, I refused to do so, because if you reveal that information, then you destroy all trust, right? Now you can't have the trust of the people that are trusting you to raise an issue for them, to raise a challenge for them. And that can be a really hard place for HR to be in between those two groups and trying to have the trust of your leadership at the same time as the trust of the teams that you're, or the people that you're wanting to support. Any suggestions on how people navigate that, those kind of competing dynamics or those kind of two areas?
Yeah, because I think it really, you have to start before the conversation and really building up that trust and relationship with whether it's the CEO or whoever you're dealing with. And some of that can come about through, you know, your one-on-one check-in, really diving into, I made this decision, I want to talk to you why. And so it lets them get inside of your thinking and your logic so that they can start to trust your judgment, I think, in a particular way. And so that way, I think if you set that table, knowing that one day eventually a situation like that is going to come up, I think it makes it a little bit easier and softer in that conversation where they may be just asking because they're trying to get at the heart of the problem. Hopefully that's the case. Sometimes we know that is absolutely not the case and they're wanting to quiet the complainant and you know something bad's going to follow. But at least in my experience, that's given a basis for, I just can't tell you that I feel like it would just break down this entire process. It's not going to get you or me where we want to go. So I'd like to focus on what we can do about this problem with the information that I can share with you.
I love that. I think that's really helpful feedback for anybody who might find themselves in that type of situation. Kim, I've loved this conversation and all the different aspects of it. I want to give you a chance if you have any final thoughts or our insights or anything you want to share with our audience before we wrap this episode up.
No, happy to. And thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you. I learned a lot with the neuroscience. So this was wonderful for me as someone who's been on both sides of the complaint process, particularly as someone who experienced something that I know millions of people have gone to. It definitely has made me, I don't know, somewhat of an evangelicalist who just wants to get out there and help as many folks as possible. I'm fairly active on LinkedIn. I like to highlight cases that people can point out, words that I'm figuring out, ways to communicate if you're in these spots. But then also too, if you want to check this out or follow this as well, I have links right from my LinkedIn that will take you to spaces where we have 24-hour call centers in my company where you can actually get free legal advice, free legal support. We work with attorneys all over the country in labor and employment who are on a contingency basis. I was able to get help ultimately through my situation with an attorney. There's a lot of folks that I think if they're doing plaintiff side work, if they're working on the side of employees, a lot of these folks could be working at big law and they choose not to. They tend to be very civil rights oriented. They tend to have huge hearts and they tend to be one man shops that are out there fighting for folks because they deeply care. Either they've experienced or someone close to them has experienced that. And so a lot of times these folks are willing to talk to folks just to help get them on the right path, help them say, okay, you may not have a case now, but if X, Y, and Z happens, you do. If you write this letter, you do. And they tend to be a fairly generous lot. No matter where you get help, I do hope folks get help somewhere if they're in these spots, because I know it's happening to a large number of folks and I'd love to see that.
I love that. It's such a valuable resource. We will include that information in the show notes as well so that people can get access to that. I think that's incredibly generous and really valuable for anybody who might be going through one of these situations or having to face these type of challenges in their current workplace. So Kim, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been great speaking with you. To our audience, as always, I just want to remind you to keep evolving, keep growing, keep expanding, keep rewiring those neural pathways so that you can live your most exceptional life, so you can have more exceptional experiences on your life journey. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, and we'll be back again next week with another episode.